Please note that some materials contained adult content or language. Listener's discretion is advised.
It was another ugly day for global markets as recession fears continued to grow as weak corporate earnings.
Beautiful 189
leaders
Dow points
from the
today.
20 biggest
of course, mostly in the last 18 minutes.
To work on a plan
has
to
become
get
such an insane paradox.
Headline, I think even bigger than Ben Bernanke can
the very likely possibility
of a situation where
everyone's
going to buy mortgage lenders countrywide seemed to spark the market more than Bernanke, Jim. And you know, we saw this yesterday. The rumor that Warren Buffett was in the market to buy insurance companies.
Now, some people have too much money. They wear it like a pair of pants. They say there's room for everybody, but you never get a chance. You can't ride that elevator. You can't climb those stairs. Because those people have too much money up there. Now, some people have too much money. And they drive it around like a car. They never pick up hitchhikers unless they know who they are. They all belong to the same club and they all wear those rings. Those people have too much money, that's the thing. If too much money puts somebody under the bridge, you know it's like water. You scoop it up, the level goes down. And too much money can choke a gift horse. All you want is a drink, but you fall in and drown. You know that French lady meant well when she said they ought to just go eat cake crumbs. She had no idea where poverty came from. Silver spoons and glass slippers, you know, their minds are just a mess. Those people have too much money, I guess. Now, some people have too much money, and I think it's time to make a change. Get some checks and balances going in the game. Get a minimum wage and a maximum wage, too, and let the chips fall. Because those people have too much money, that's all. That's right. Some people have too much money, that's all.
Truth and lies coming up slowly. Many people, many places, sick and tired. Coming up slowly.
They need really trillion after trillion to bail out the bad debts, because that is how deep the hole is that Wall Street and behind it, free market economics of the Chicago school variety, has led the country into.
You know, the Americans are in denial. They don't understand how bad this fascist gulag casino state has organized, how well they've organized, to take arms against them.
Keep you satisfied.
If you want to see what is likely to happen to the United States, you should look at what Mr. Rubin did when America had a completely free hand in redesigning the Russian economy. This was their ideal. You've seen that since the 1996 giveaways in Russia, the Russian population has fallen more than it fell in World War II. That financial devastation today is even more devastating than military destruction. And the result is a shortened life expectancy, lower birth rates, depression. The effect is psychological and social, not merely economic.
Goldman Sachs knows that they're raping America. They do it by design. They're rapists. They're financial rapists and arsonists. And the fact that they're allowed to continue in the American economy as without being pilloried or hung up and flogged is a testament to the hubris and the ego that is at the core of the American problem. Unfortunately, because of unbroken years of expansion around the world and imperialistic expansion around the world, by America, American bankers, they have developed this sense of immortality. And nobody right now is doing anything to stop it. So this is not going to stop.
Dr. Hudson, I was about to ask you about the role that the media has played in this. There's been an awful lot of disinformation put out, hasn't there?
That's the role of the media these days. And what would you expect from a media that's been centralized in the hands of the wealthiest classes? The media have acted as cheerleaders for the act, for Wall Street, for the real estate industry, and they have indeed been promoting disinformation. You don't get any of what I've been saying, not only in the media, but on educational TV, on McNeil Lehrer or any of the other reports. You get a little bit more on PBS. You get much more on radio, and of course, much, much more on the internet. And the internet is really the only place where you can get a very open discussion of the problem.
If you want a good parallel to the current U.S. situation, I think the Argentinian parallel is a good one, more so than the Weimar Republic, more so than the Great Depression, more so than the 1907 panic, more so than the recession of the mid-70s. I think it's the Argentinian collapse, which is the analog to the current U.S. situation, and how the corruption, you see, the corruption of politics and finance worked its way into the system, because during the crash of 29, the markets got huge and they blew up and there was a response, but it was a market-centered event. Here, you've got a politically centered event. Most of the damage on Wall Street and around the economy in the U.S. is a combination of the bankers and the politicians colluding to create the festering cesspool of malinvestments that created the current crisis, and therefore you've got to look to Argentina for a parallel.
The fact that this Goldman Sachs story is not covered in any U.S. paper or media outlet. It was covered in the Mail in the U.K.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is that, so all the numbers are going to be in pounds, but what it is that the U.S. taxpayer has injected into Goldman Sachs £6 billion worth of dollars. Goldman Sachs are paying themselves in Christmas bonuses, £7 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So the entire bailout money to Goldman Sachs has gone to, cover 90% of their bonus package.
Right. And the attitude of the Goldman Sachs bankers, as I know from working on Wall Street, is they consider themselves above the law. They consider themselves to be the architects and the engineers and the cogs that run the U.S. economy. Therefore, the economy, the greatest economy in the world that represents the greatest hope for freedom in the world. And the ego is such where Goldman Sachs bankers feel completely justified in taking the $6 billion or $7 billion bailout package from the federal government, from the U.S. taxpayer, and simply putting it in their own pockets and saying, well, we need to protect our wealth because we're the ones who are saving you against terrorism. We're saving you against the bad guys and the possibility of there being rogue elements entering into the country. We're the ones that suffered on 9/11. You know, we deserve the money. You know, as I've said on this show many times, 9/11 didn't go far enough. They only, well, how many bankers went down that day? You know, 1,500, 1,700. That was just the beginning of what could have been a worthwhile purging of the greed and excess on Wall Street.
Well, since you've brought up fraud in the mortgage-backed securities, everyone seems to agree that many of these securities are worthless. But doesn't the fraud go much deeper? For instance, I've heard that the same worthless mortgage shows up in multiple bundled securities. Do you think this is true?
It's reported to be true, and the cure promises to be much worse, make the problem much worse. Mr. Paulson and the Democrats agree that there should be a regulator, a single regulator, over the financial and real estate industry. Now, at present, Washington has actually brought a lawsuit to stop the attorneys generals for various states from prosecuting fraudulent mortgage loans. And they say that only the government can do this under some obscure law from the 1840s because we're going to regulate. You're not allowed to do anything. And then the government has done nothing to enforce the law. Now, suppose the super regulator is going to say, we have the authority to regulate financial fraud. Nobody else does. All they have to do is put someone like Alan Greenspan in charge of this. All they have to do is put a deregulator in charge of it and do absolutely nothing. And nobody else in the entire country, no attorney general, no prosecutor, not private suits, nobody can stop the fraud. So the centralizing the regulatory process in the hands of deregulators appointed by the industry to be regulated, by the major campaign contributors, institutionalizes systematic ripoff of the Treasury.
What would you do with $3 trillion? The $3 trillion shopping spree is your chance to find out. Want to reign over your own island nation? Go right ahead. Or maybe fund research that will cure a deadly disease. It's up to you. You can even wage an endless war that will cripple America's economy. With the $3 trillion shopping spree, anything's possible. Bill in Los Angeles bought 100,000 luxury yachts, 20,000 sprawling estates, and 650,000 private islands. Mary in Michigan gave healthcare to all Americans and still had $2.8 trillion left over. George B. in Washington started an illegal war that resulted in 151,000 dead Iraqi civilians. Gary in Indiana bought 1.5 billion pounds of beluga caviar. Debbie in New York bought 500 schools in her home state and still had $2,987,000,000,000 left for school supplies. Donald R. in Arlington, Virginia destabilized an entire region and displaced 4 million innocent people. What will you do with $3 trillion? Go to www.3trillion.org and spend, spend, spend.
Psst, do something.
I think I read in the newspapers about what you're referring to. Was part of this where the states themselves, the state governments, wanted to go after fraud?
Yes.
And they were stopped by the federal government?
That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
People like Mr. Mazzello should be in jail. Franklin Roosevelt said that nothing in politics is accidental. Nothing that happens in politics really is an accident. So when you have a plan that's going to fail very shortly, like Mr. Paulson's plan, and he says, gee, I guess I didn't understand Wall Street, you're talking about one of the smartest guys on Wall Street from a firm that's considered to be the smartest financial firm on Wall Street. So when they claim, gee, it's just incompetent, I guess our giveaway didn't work, you can be pretty sure that this is not an accident, that it wasn't out of ignorance they did it. You can assume that they knew just exactly what would happen, that they knew it would be a failure, but it would be a failure that gives their constituency $700 billion, 700 billionaires, while tightening the screws on the rest of Americans.
I'm disappointed in the vote with the United States Congress on the economic rescue plan.
Poor Lehman Brothers, y'all got the shaft.
Shaft!
The government said, good luck with that.
Shaft!
And AIG, old Uncle Sam, he loaned you $85 billion, but now he owns you. Some cry out, we've become a socialist state, while others say we need to regulate. Should I vote McCain or pull the lever for Obama? I'm thinking either way, I'll be moving back in with mama. But the cooking's good, and I think she'll drive me to work, save money on groceries and gas. You see, I don't have much job security. I'm an internet comedian. I'm not even sure if that's technically a job. I don't think it is. I can't put my finger on it, but you know things have gone wrong when I can't even afford to finish this.
So I think what you have to remember is, as long as we feel it's a fat cat bailout, the public is absolutely frustrated and won't go with it. Every single financial guy who got into a mess has to give his golden parachute, leave it at the door.
What about people that collected large bonuses as a result of 40-to-1 leverage that Main Street is very offended right. by? And that one of the reasons you have 300-to-1 voter opposition to this plan is they know that those bonuses were obtained by assuming risks that the person taking the risk knew they could never, or very possibly knew they could never.
They didn't even know what they were taking on, the heads of the
firm. I just don't think you can go backwards. You can't go backwards and take money back from someone who's already tapped it.
Even if the voters are free, well, then the voters apparently will refuse to bail you out.
You got both hands on the steering wheel. You say you want to take another turn. You think your backup plan is a robust deal, but we ain't got $700 billion to burn. And I don't want to pay for the shit you pulled, when I can't even pay to get my tank half full. I don't want to pay another penny for what you did. I don't want to spend another dime on you, when you can't even help a kid get through school. So don't expect us to pay for the shit you pulled. You say yes, I say no. You say why, I think you're pretty low down. Hey, what about the folks that are losing their homes? You won't bail them out, now you're in a sinking boat. Wow. Got one hand in my pocket and the other around my throat. Give me ice cubes in the winter, now you wanna steal my coat. The gift is in the giving and it ain't our lesson to learn. No. I don't wanna pay for the last 8 years, and I don't wanna see your crocodile tears. I don't wanna spend another dime on the shit you pulled. No, no, no. When I can't even pay for the price of gas, you got your hand out, now we'll kiss my ass. I don't wanna spend another penny on the likes
they say there's a liquidity crisis. There's no liquidity crisis. It's a debt crisis.
That's correct. It's a bad debt crisis and a bad investment crisis. And Wall Street says, gee, we thought that in the game of musical chairs, we'd have a chance to get out quick, just like Goldman Sachs was able to get out quick from a lot of the junk mortgages. And they weren't able to get out quick enough, so they said, we want the government to take the loss. We don't want to take the loss. Will you please buy all of our bad investments at the price we paid for them so that we won't take a loss? We'd much rather the taxpayers take a loss. And Mr. Obama said yes. Mrs. Clinton said yes. And the Democrats said yes. The Republicans tried to say no. They said, we don't want any part of this. Many Republicans obviously did vote for it, but this is a Democratic plan for the incoming Democratic administration to impose with a vengeance. And it's the Democrats that have put the class war back in business.
Well, we hear in the media the claim that, oh, well, the Republicans were against it, but for the wrong reasons.
What can one say to that? The fact, yes, that's true. They were against it because if you look at what they said this is socialism. Well, it's nothing like socialism at all. When you give away money to the wealthiest class, this is old-fashioned kleptocracy, and it's a step back toward feudalism. It's not a step toward socialism at all. So in that sense, the rhetoric that the Republicans used was their usual silly rhetoric. But the fact is they did oppose the act. And if you look at the statements that were made on the House floor and the Senate floor, statements that do not appear in the New York Times, that do not appear in the Chicago Tribune, that do not appear in the Wall Street Journal, then you'll see that these congressmen who voted against it were pretty smart. And the media is refusing to say what they actually said. The media is refusing to cite the reasons that the congressmen voted against it. You don't find any discussion at all of Dennis Kucinich's reasons for voting against it. The fact that there was no need to panic, the fact that there were no hearings. It's unbelievable that an act of this magnitude by government, never before has there been an act like this with no congressional hearings, no Bank Oversight Committee hearings, no testimony by expert witnesses, absolutely no discussion at all, a total clampdown, almost done under martial law. And that's why I said that last Friday is the date at which American democracy ended and the oligarchy imposed its brute force.
The one bankruptcy at a day plan, that's not working. The one shotgun wedding day at a plan, like Citigroup and Wachovia Bank, how many of those are you going to arrange at this point? That's why traders down here are in a somewhat of a state of despair. Take a look at the big financial and commodity stocks. Brand new lows on many commodity stocks because the other trade is the global slowdown trade that's been going on. So you see.
All right, Dylan, thanks so much. We're down 8.25% right now, and you'd have to go back till 2000, really, when the bubble didn't just burst and when it exploded to find out a day where we had a percentage decline of this magnitude, and we haven't gotten to that point level.
Continues to turn, and Warren Buffett's got $5 billion to burn. But taking from the poor and giving to the rich won't work. No, I don't wanna pay for the shit you pull when I can't even pay to get my tank half full. I don't wanna spend another penny on what you did. No, no, no. I don't wanna pay for the last 8 years. I don't wanna see no crocodile tears. I don't wanna spend another dime on the likes of you, yeah. I don't wanna spend another penny on the shit you pull.
Uncle Sam says, turn in your coins. Now that President Bush has declared martial law, it will be illegal to be in possession of precious metals after the first of the year. That's why all citizens are urged to redeem their coins at any of the over 48,000 Halliburton service stations throughout the United States. We call it Operation Change for the Better, and for good reason. First, the new money is based on a petroleum standard, so the coins will appear in gallon denominations instead of dollars, which makes sense since that's where most of your income goes anyway. Let's familiarize ourselves with the new coin, starting with the 10-gallon denomination, which features the president's mother, Barbara Bush, who will forever be remembered for single-handedly changing the world's perspective by noting that the refugees of Hurricane Katrina were better off after the disaster than before. This happy fact is memorialized on the reverse with the adorable image of two lost children paddling past the Superdome. The 5-gallon coin celebrates our comatose press and the 5th anniversary of Larry King's momentous interview with Elizabeth Taylor on the eve of the Iraq War. This coin is also known as the Buffaloed Press Nickel because of the American bison on the reverse butting heads with the liberal media. The 1-gallon coin, or the Condi, honors Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, whose solution to Middle East conflict is summarized on the reverse, piping Persia for peace. The half-gallon coin, or the Scalia, depicts the Supreme Court justice against a backdrop of uncounted Florida ballots, while on the reverse, presidential advisor Karl Rove celebrates the modern miracle of electronic voting. Finally, there's the 1-cup coin, or the Bracero, honoring the millions of aliens the president welcomed into the American labor pool. It features the unknown Bracero on the front, while on the back, more illegals jumped the border in Roger Clark Wilson's Gateway to Servitude. Yes, a fitting tribute to big business's final triumph over organized labor. The larger denominations begin with the 25-gallon Royal Limbaugh, celebrating uniformity of speech. It features a Greco-Roman interpretation of commentators Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, and Ann Coulter under the banner One Media, One Voice. The 50-gallon coin pays homage to Donald Rumsfeld and the concept of democracy at gunpoint. The 75-gallon coin features Vice President Cheney and the creed for which he's dedicated the bulk of his public life, In Greed We Trust. On the reverse, an American eagle and the price of gas engage in a symbolic race for the moon. Finally, there's the 100-gallon coin, or the Bush doubloon. The presidential credo, fighting terrorism by creating it, is featured. While on the reverse, the events of 9/11 are recalled under the motto, Lest they forget, we'll remind. Here, a new World Trade Center rises from the ashes of the Pentagon, crested by the men of Iwo Jima. On the right, Vice President Cheney is seen canceling North American fighter cover. While on the left, the president reads My Pet Goat to Florida kindergartners. Yes, it's a vivid snapshot of that fateful day, captured for all time in 100% depleted uranium. Be among the first to redeem coins worth 100 gallons or more and receive this limited edition doubloon featuring President Bush along with Presidents Hoover and Harding, kindred leaders who also labored under a plundered economy. Yes, it's out with the old, in with the new. Operation Change for the Better from the United States government and Halliburton, working together to round up every cent you have.
But I believe this really is the most important passage that Milton Friedman ever wrote, and really is the most important passage for all of us to understand about how this ideology beat us.
Myself, I'm a man of wealth and taste. I've been around for a long, long year. Stole many a man's soul and faith.
We now have evidence that this market model is broken. And clearly what is needed is some dramatic structural adjustment in the USA. So let's play IMF. Now, in Argentina, they did try to use the 2001 crisis to push through more structural adjustment. But the problem, and the reason why this didn't work in Argentina, was because just a few months earlier, the IMF had been holding up Argentina as the model student. And they had already privatized everything. I mean, they came up with a list of more things they should privatize, but it was just like the ports, because that was all that was left. They had privatized everything. But also, the country itself had been very much indoctrinated in the idea that they were the model student, that they had followed the rules. And so it was much harder to sell the idea that you needed more neoliberal structural adjustment. And instead, what you had was a popular uprising and a revolt against, and I think this is really important in this moment, against the entire expert class. The slogan in the streets, I think, is really good slogan for this moment, which was que se vayan todos, all of them must go. And you know, this was the period where they went through five presidents in 3 weeks, but it wasn't just the politicians, it was the pundits, it was the economists, and because they had boasted so much about the miracle of Argentina, they found themselves really bereft of the usual tools. Now, I think the United States in this moment, you know, is experiencing something a little bit similar. In the sense that there is this consensus, and Obama has turned his election campaign into a kind of referendum on Friedmanite economic policies. I mean, whether or not he's actually going to do it, I think depends very much on the forces that we're talking about in this room. Okay, I want to talk about some short-term structural adjustments, okay? Kind of pressure that can be placed on Obama right now. Bob Rubin, Larry Summers have got to go. I'm not just trying to make a popular point here. These guys are advising Obama on a day-to-day basis. When he wants to say that he, you know, has great people surrounding him, he talks about Bob Rubin. And that fantastic piece in the New York Times yesterday, which I never thought I would read, questioning the Greenspan legacy, was very effective in pairing Rubin with Greenspan at every turn in creating the crisis we have now. So we have a real opening right now to, I think, you know, if Move On wasn't Move On, they would be using their networks to be saying that these guys should be exiled, that they broke it, and that does not give them the right to feed on the remains. You know, we saw the two political campaigns calling for, actually issuing a joint statement about the bailout, much to their shame. How about pushing the political campaigns to, which are both running on this, on these platforms of getting the special interests and the lobbyists out of Washington, which as we know is complete bullshit, get the lobbyists out of the bailout discussions, okay? It is atrocious, and they are swarming on this, right now, in terms of having a say that they should not have in who is eligible for the bailout, and also resisting change within the context of the bailout. These are the people who created the crisis we're in, and there should just be a blanket ban on lobbying with anything having to do with the bailout. And then, of course, we need to make the best of a bad situation, which is that they've passed this terrible piece of legislation. But as Doug said, you know, there is room to be arguing for equity. And I think it's one of the things that's incredible that's happening now is they're handing out no-bid contracts to the very companies that created this mess. The new frontier for disaster capitalism, as you know, I've been writing about this expanding economy and going from Iraq to Hurricane Katrina and just feeding off of it, the next disaster. Well, the next frontier of disaster capitalism is capitalism, okay? It's cleaning up after capitalism. It's a $700 billion industry and expanding. Okay, so just one last point to think big, because I'm thinking small here. We know that this crisis that has been transferred, that is being transferred from Wall Street to Washington, all of these bad debts that are now exploding on the public books are going to be used by the right, and that includes people like Bob Rubin, to argue that whoever the next president is, they can't afford to keep their campaign promises. Okay. Yes. Think of this as Republican insurance against an Obama presidency. Okay. And everything he's saying, yes, we can. No, you can't. You can't because we've just dumped this huge crisis on your lap. And Obama's already capitulating. Okay. Huge surprise. But he's already said, well, maybe I can't afford some of the things like green energy and so on. We'll have to phase them in. All right. I've been calling for the nationalization of Exxon. All right. because I think if nationalization's on the table, let's go big. Let's not just nationalize junk. Let's nationalize the biggest corporate criminals of them all. The people who have left us with the biggest crisis that we actually face, which is climate change, which is global warming. And now we're going to hear that we actually can't afford the investments to get us to address this crisis, to change course. That addressing climate change is a luxury we can no longer afford. This is the fight we have to win. And we can't nationalize them, because how would you tell the difference between a nationalized oil company and what you have right now? So we need to internationalize them. There needs to be an international trust, and these huge profits won by the oil and gas industry have to be the money that we use to transform to a sustainable economy. I know there's a lot of legal arguments that we need to win to get from A to B, but I think that that's a big idea that I'll just throw out there. Thank you.
Thank you. end welfare as we know it, and get those greedy chiselers off the dole. It's time to end welfare as we know it. Teach them a little self-control. For far too long we've allowed these corporate hogs to belly up to the public trough. No more welfare as we know it. No more handouts. Cut them off.
The social creation of private wealth. Most capitalists would disagree that profits are created by workers. They believe that their profits represent their share of the work. In fact, capitalists do know socially useful work. Their job is to maximize profits, to get more out of their workers, to outfox their competitors, and to avoid paying taxes. A society that produced for human need would have no use for such work. Others say that capitalists are richer because they are smarter or work harder. This is a delusion. In their book, I Didn't Do It Alone, Society's Contribution to Individual Wealth and Success, Chuck Collins, Mike Lapham, and Scott Klinger explain how important luck is to individual accomplishment. Where you're born, the time in which you live, the family into which you're born, your skin color, and your sex strongly influence the possibility of success. They provide the example of Nick Szabo, who survived a plane crash while the person sitting next to him was killed. Szabo used the insurance money from his injuries to buy Silicon Valley real estate and make a fortune. No business could prosper, and no capitalist could become wealthy without the social support of property laws, laws of inheritance, and the patent protection of ideas, methods, and products. Bill Gates built his mega fortune by buying and selling software that other people produced. He could do this only because the legal system upholds the right of the capitalist class to privately own the means of production and therefore all the wealth that workers create. Business also depends on the publicly funded infrastructure of society. Roads, highways, bridges, railways, airports, shipping ports, power grids, communication systems, police, schools, and medical facilities. The auto industry would quickly go belly up if it had to finance the building and maintenance of roads and bridges. Billions of dollars of government money fund the research and development that support corporate profits. Ross Perot, who ran for U.S. president in 1992, was called the welfare billionaire for using public money to build his fortune. The pharmaceutical industry has become the most lucrative business in America by relying on taxpayer-funded scientific research. While business profits from the use of social resources, the legion of low-paid workers who pay for and provide these resources receive no portion of the profits. Nor is society repaid in the form of corporate taxes. Tax deductions and loopholes see to that. According to the New York Times, quote, almost two-thirds of America's corporations paid no federal income taxes during the late 1990s, when corporate profits were soaring. 9 out of 10 companies paid less than the equivalent of 5% of their total income, close quote. If the social basis of private wealth were openly acknowledged, then all of society would have a claim on this wealth. The myth of the self-made man or woman helps to keep socially produced wealth in private hands.
You got a penthouse in the city and another home in the hills. You got a corner office on the 51st floor and you walk on a carpet made of $100 bills. Well, I look at you up there in your plush office chair and I wonder what is going through your brain. As you look outside your window, watch the people moving by below. You must be thinking about your capital gains. And tell me exactly what it is you do. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that you make your money from the goofy work that other people do. Well, they're slaving away in fields and factories. You're sipping your coffee on Madison Avenue. that they'll get their share. You say that you worked hard to get there, but I'm asking if you see from that tinted window in the air how many people must be poor so you can be a billionaire. You say this is the way it has to be competitive in the economy. Poverty is a market incentive to keep people from being lazy. And I say to you, if you believe that shit they taught you in school, you must be crazy. Sometimes it makes me angry. Sometimes I'd like to cry. How many people been working all their lives for nothing? They'll be working until they die. Should I call you evil? Should I call you cruel? Did you just come from the right family and go to all the right schools? Tell me, what do you think of your life? Does it feed your soul? Come the life you are making for us is spinning out of control. Sometimes blame is just like honey. Gets all over everything, and it's never enough to be careful what you buy when you're shopping. In a land known for democracy, it's amazing how it comes to be. Freedom is the choice between Coke and Pepsi. So tell me your free markets will satisfy our needs. Don't tell me that what's good for Monsanto is good for me. You rob us of our livelihoods and our grandmother's seeds. Your endless thirst for profit is a social disease. Should I call you evil? Should I call you cruel? Did you just come from the right family and go to all the right schools? Tell me, what do you think of your life? Does it feed your soul?
Looking at a colossal meltdown that's just beginning. And Paulson acts as though his main job is to enable the lifeboats to be manned by the speculators while everyone else sinks. We have to have a fix for the homeowners, and one of the things that I recommended early on was for the government to take a controlling interest in the mortgage-backed securities and to direct workouts on interest and principal and extending terms of the loan to keep people in their homes. That's the first thing, and then we need a jobs program behind that.
Capitalism differs from previous class societies in the extent to which it denies the majority any control over the means of making a living. In feudal Europe, peasants could own small plots of land, even though the landlord took most of what was produced. Craftspeople also owned their own tools and could make a living selling their products. Capitalism revolutionized the way work was done. Small family farms have been swallowed up by the giant farming corporations called agribusiness. Artisans cannot compete with factory production. With few exceptions, the modern capitalist class controls virtually all means of production. Land, livestock, factories, fisheries, mines, machines, methods and technology, even seeds, plants, and animals are patented. There seems to be no limit to the process of claiming every square inch of the planet as private property. Corporations claim ownership over the water supply and charge us for its use. Nations claim ownership of airspace. There are even disputes over who owns the moon. Only the national debt is collectively owned. How did the ruling class get so much power? Like every ruling class before it, the capitalist class established itself by theft, by claiming exclusive possession over what had formerly been held in common. In the United States, land was taken by force from Aboriginal peoples, and many founding families built their fortunes by buying and selling this land. Others enriched themselves through slave labor. Such, quote, primitive accumulation laid the foundation for more sophisticated capital accumulation, as the following example shows. Profit. Let's say that someone manages, by hook or by crook, to obtain enough surplus to hire workers to construct a factory. The factory owner then offers a wage to entice people to work in his factory. In exchange for this wage, the capitalist claims ownership over everything the workers produce. Security systems ensure that no worker removes company property. Let's say that each worker can build one machine every 8 hours, or the length of one workday. At the end of the day, the worker takes home her wages and leaves the machine that she made in her employer's possession. Let's say that this machine can be used to build more machines. The next day, the capitalist demands that the worker use the machine she made yesterday to produce two more machines today. If the worker insists on being paid twice as much to make two machines, or if she insists on working only 4 hours, the length of time it now takes to make one machine, or if she insists on taking home the second machine, she would enjoy higher wages, a shorter workday, or possession of a growing number of machines. However, the capitalist would make no profit. The capitalist is not a philanthropist. He invested in the factory to make a profit, not to raise workers' living standards. The capitalists demand that the worker accept the same wage as before and work the same 8 hours as before and give up her right to both machines. That way, the capitalist will enjoy 100% profit, equivalent to one additional machine every 8 hours. The capitalist wants the worker to be the philanthropist and to build the capitalist's fortune. The essence of class conflict lies in the dispute over who should own what the worker produces. The worker points out that she made the machine. The capitalist claims that he paid for the factory tools and raw materials. He neglects to mention and hopes that we have forgotten that he or his ancestors stole the assets needed to acquire these things. The state sides with the capitalist, declaring that the factory is his private property, so that everything made there belongs to him. The worker is commanded to relinquish all rights to what she produces. The capitalist is overjoyed. He gets to keep the value of what the worker makes, which is always more than what he pays her in wages. The process of taking surplus away from those who produce it is called exploitation. The surplus taken by the capitalist is called profit. Profit that is used to extract more surplus from workers is called capital. Capitalists live to accumulate capital. Every process of capital accumulation involves repeated changes of capital from one form to the other. Money capital is used to buy means of production, raw materials, and labor power, productive capital. This is put together in the production process to turn out commodities, commodity capital. These commodities are then exchanged for money, money capital. This money is then used to buy more means of production, raw materials, labor power, and so on. Capitalism is a social arrangement between the capitalist class and the working class, where the capitalist takes what the worker produces today in order to more effectively exploit the worker tomorrow. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal.
So let us not talk falsely now. The hour is getting late.
You know, there's a tremendous amount of fakery and fraud and people looking the other way and people knowing they're doing the wrong thing. And at the same time, generating enormous fees for all this. And finally, you get a financial system that is turned into a monster compared to the rest of the economy.
All the women came and went, barefoot servants too. Outside in the distance, a wildcat did growl. Two riders were approaching, the wind began to howl.
The so-called money that Wall Street generated wasn't really there in the first place. It was represented maybe in pixels in a computer, on a hard drive somewhere, or maybe in paper somewhere. But since these things, by and large, were to such an extraordinary degree frauds and swindles, the money really isn't there. And now it's being discovered that it's not there, as these securities cannot be, as they say, marked to market. And they cannot be sold, and their value is functionally zero. Now, the larger problem is that not only is American financing choking on this stuff, but world financing is choking on this stuff because it was distributed so lavishly throughout the global system. And so now there's a danger that unless, in essence, the U.S. government calls this crap back and absorbs it and takes a hit on it, that the entire world finance system will choke on it.
Right there on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line? Just waiting for bread. Can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, and rivet and line. Once I built a tower, and now it's done. Brother, can you spare one dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell. A fella that yiggity-doodle-dee-dum, yiggity-doodle-dee-dum. Half a million men went slogging through hell. I was the kid with a drum. Say, don't you remember? My name is Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal, I'm your pal. Brother, brother, can you spare one dime? Brother, can you spare one dime? Brother, can you spare one dime? Can you spare one day? Brother, can you spare one day?
We'll close with an excerpt of a piece that James Howard Kunstler posted October 25th on alternet.org. Let's say that we are witnessing the two stages of a tsunami. The current disappearance of wealth in the form of debts repudiated, bets wealth strong, contracts canceled, and Lehman Brothers-style sob stories played out is like the withdrawal of the sea. Poor, curious little monkey humans stand on the beach transfixed by the strangeness of the event as the water recedes and the seafloor is exposed and all kinds of exotic creatures are seen thrashing in the mud, while the skeletons of historic wrecks are exposed to view and a great stench of organic decay wafts towards the strand. Then comes the second stage, the tidal wave itself, which in this case will be a horrific monetary inflation, roaring back over the mudflats towards the landmass, crashing over the beach, and ripping apart all the hotels and houses and infrastructure there. While it drowns the poor, curious monkey humans, who were too enthralled by the weird spectacle to make for higher ground. The killer tidal wave washes away all the things they have labored to build for decades, all their poignant little effects and chattels, and the survivors are left keening amidst the wreckage as the sea once again returns to normal in its eternal cradle. So that's what I think we will get, an interval of deflationary depression followed by a destructive wave of inflation that will wipe out both constructed debt and constructed savings, scraping the financial landscape clean. There's no question that one stage is underway, but we can be sure the giant wave of money recklessly loaned into existence in just a few weeks' time will wash back through the global economy, leaving a swath of destruction.